think that they are the real fish, that the other is an illusion. Both fish are alive and act as if they are the true fish. Which description is correct? Actually, both are, since they are mathematically equivalent and indistinguishable. What excited string theorists is the fact that five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space is relatively easy to calculate with, while four-dimensional field theories are notoriously difficult to handle. Even today, after decades of hard work, our most powerful computers cannot solve the four-dimensional quark model and derive the masses of the proton and neutron. The equations for the quarks themselves are fairly well understood, but solving them in four dimensions to obtain the properties of protons and neutrons has proved to be more difficult than previously thought. One goal is to calculate the masses and properties of the proton and neutron using this strange duality. This holographic duality may also have practical applications, such as solving the information problem in black hole physics. In four dimensions, it is extremely difficult to prove that information isn't lost when we throw objects through a black hole. But such a space is dual to a five-dimensional world, in which information is perhaps never lost. The hope is that problems that are intractable in four dimensions, such as the information problem, calculating the masses of the quark model, and so forth, may eventually be solved in five dimensions, where the mathematics is simpler. And it is always possible that this analogy is actually a reflection of the real world, that we really exist as holograms. Is the universe a computer program? John Wheeler, as we saw earlier, believed that all physical reality could be reduced to pure information. Bekenstein takes the idea of black hole information one step further into uncharted waters by asking the question, is the entire universe a computer program? Are we just bits on a cosmic CD? The question of whether we are living in a computer program was brought brilliantly to the silver screen in the movie The Matrix, where aliens have reduced all physical reality to a computer program. Billions of humans think that they are leading everyday lives, oblivious of the fact that all this is a computer-generated fantasy, while their real bodies are asleep in pods where the aliens use them as a power source. In the movie, it is possible to run smaller computer programs that create artificial mini-realities. If one wants to become a kung fu master or a helicopter pilot, one just inserts a CD into a computer, the program is fed into our brain, and presto, one instantly learns these complicated skills. As the CD is run, a whole new sub-reality is created. But it raises an intriguing question. Can all of reality be placed on a CD? The computer power necessary to simulate reality for billions of sleeping humans is truly staggering. But in theory, can the entire universe be digitalized in a finite computer program? The roots of this question go back to Newton's laws of motion, with very practical applications for commerce and our lives. Mark Twain was famous for stating, "Everyone complains about the weather, but no one ever does anything about it." Modern civilization cannot change the course of even a single thunderstorm. But physicists have asked a more modest question. Can we predict the weather? Can a computer program be devised that will predict the course of complex weather patterns on Earth? This has very practical applications for everyone concerned about the weather, from farmers wanting to know when to harvest their crops to meteorologists wanting to know the course of global warming in this century. In principle, computers can use Newton's laws of motion to compute with almost arbitrary accuracy the course of molecules that make up the weather. But in practice, computer programs are extremely crude and are not reliable at predicting the weather beyond a few days or so, at best. To predict the weather, one would need to determine the motion of every air molecule, something that is magnitudes beyond our most powerful computer. There is also the problem of chaos theory and the butterfly effect, where even the tiniest vibration from a butterfly's wing can cause a ripple effect that, at key junctures, may decisively change the weather hundreds of miles away. Mathematicians summarize this situation by stating that the smallest model that can accurately describe the weather is the weather itself. Rather than microanalyzing each molecule, the best we can do is to look for estimates of tomorrow's weather and also larger trends and patterns, such as the greenhouse effect. So it is exceedingly difficult for a Newtonian world to be reduced to a computer program, since there are too many variables and too many butterflies. But in the quantum world, strange things happen. Bekenstein, as we saw, showed that the total information content of a black hole is proportional to the surface area of its event horizon. There is an intuitive way of seeing this. Many physicists believe that the smallest possible distance is the Planck length of 10 to the negative 33rd power centimeter. At this incredibly small distance, space-time is no longer smooth, but becomes foamy, resembling a froth of bubbles. We can divide up the spherical surface of the horizon into tiny squares, each one the size of the Planck length. If each of these squares contains one bit of information, and we add up all the squares, we find roughly the total information content of the black hole. This seems to indicate that each of these Planck squares is the smallest unit of information. If this is true, then Bekenstein claims that perhaps information is the true language of physics, not field theory. As he puts it, field theory, with its infinity, cannot be the final story. Ever since the work of Michael Faraday in the 19th century, physics has been formulated in the language of fields, which are smooth and continuous, and which measure the strength of magnetism, electricity, gravity, and so on at any point in space-time. But field theory is based on continuous structures, not digitalized ones. A field can occupy any value, while a digitalized number can only represent discrete numbers based on zeros and ones. This is the difference, for example, between a smooth rubber sheet found in Einstein's theory and a fine wire mesh. The rubber sheet can be divided up into an infinite number of points, while a wire mesh has a smallest distance, the mesh length. Bekenstein suggests that a final theory must be concerned not with fields, not even with space-time, but rather with information exchange among physical processes. If the universe can be digitalized and reduced to zeros and ones, then what is the total information content of the universe? Bekenstein estimates that a black hole about a centimeter across could contain 10 to the 66th power bits of information. But if an object a centimeter in size can hold that many bits of information, then he estimates that the visible universe probably contains much more information, no less than 10 to the 100th power bits of information, which can in principle be squeezed into a sphere a tenth of a light year across. This colossal number, 1 followed by 100 zeros, is called a Google. If this picture is correct, we have a strange situation. It might mean that while a Newtonian world cannot be simulated by computers, or can only be simulated by a system as large as itself, in a quantum world, perhaps the universe itself can be put onto a CD. In theory, if we can put 10 to the 100th power bits of information on a CD, we can watch any event in our universe unfold in our living room. In principle, one could arrange or reprogram the bits on this CD so that physical reality proceeds in a different fashion. In some sense, one would have a godlike ability to rewrite the script. Bekenstein also admits that the total information content of the universe could be much larger than that. In fact, the smallest volume that can contain the information of the universe may be the size of the universe itself. If this is true, then we are back to where we started. The smallest system that can model the universe is the universe itself. String theory, however, offers a slightly different interpretation of the smallest distance and whether we can digitalize the universe on a CD. M-theory possesses what is called T-duality. Recall that the Greek philosopher Zeno thought that a line could be divided into an infinite number of points, without limit. Today, quantum physicists like Bekenstein believe that the smallest distance may be the Planck distance of 10 to the negative 33rd power centimeters, where the fabric of space-time becomes foamy and bubbly. But M-theory gives us a new twist to this. Let's say that we take a string theory and wrap up one dimension into a circle of radius r. Then we take another string and wrap up one dimension into a circle of radius 1 over r. By comparing these two quite different theories, we find that they are exactly the same. Now let r become extremely small, much smaller than the Planck length. This means that the physics within the Planck length is identical to the physics outside the Planck length. At the Planck length, space-time may become lumpy and foamy, but the physics inside the Planck length and the physics at very large distances can be smooth and, in fact, are identical. This duality was first found in 1984 by my old colleague Keiji Kikawa and his student Masami Yamasaki of Osaka University. Although string theory apparently concludes that there is a smallest distance, the Planck length, physics does not abruptly end at the Planck length. The new twist is that physics smaller than the Planck length is equivalent to physics larger than the Planck length. If this rather topsy-turvy interpretation is correct, then it means that even within the smallest distance of string theory, an entire universe can exist. In other words, we can still use field theory with its continuous, not digitalized structures to describe the universe, even to distances well inside the Planck energy. So perhaps the universe is not a computer program at all. In any event, since this is a well-defined problem, time will tell. This T-duality is the justification for the pre-Big Bang scenario of Veneziano I mentioned earlier. In that model, a black hole collapses down to the Planck length and then bounces back into the Big Bang. This bounce is not an abrupt event, but the smooth T-duality between a black hole smaller than the Planck length and an expanding universe larger than the Planck length. The end. If M-theory is successful, if it is indeed a theory of everything, is it the end of physics as we know it? The answer is no. Let me give you an example. Even if we know the rules of chess, knowing the rules does not make us a grand master. Similarly, knowing the laws of the universe does not mean that we are grand masters in terms of understanding its rich variety of solutions. Personally, I think it still might be a bit premature to apply M-theory to cosmology, although it gives a startling new picture of the way the universe might have begun. The main problem, I think, is that the model is not in its final form. M-theory may very well be the theory of everything, but I believe that it is far from finished. The theory has been evolving backward since 1968, and its final equations have still not been found. For example, string theory can be formulated via string field theory, as Kikawa and I showed years ago. The counterpart of these equations for M-theory is unknown. Several problems confront M-theory. One is that physicists are now drowning in P-brains. A series of papers has been written trying to catalog the bewildering variety of membranes that can exist in different dimensions. There are membranes shaped like a donut with a hole, a donut with multiple holes, intersecting membranes, and so forth. One is reminded of what happens when the fabled blind wise men confront an elephant. Touching the elephant in different places, each comes up with his own theory. One wise man, touching the tail, says that the elephant is a one-brain, a string. Another wise man, touching the ear, says that the elephant is a two-brain, a membrane. Finally, the last says that the other two wise men are wrong. Touching the legs, which feel like tree trunks, the third wise man says that the elephant is really a three-brain. Because they are blind, they cannot see the big picture, that the sum total of a one-brain, two-brain, and three-brain is nothing but a single animal, an elephant. Similarly, it's hard to believe that the hundreds of membranes found in M-theory are somehow fundamental. At present, we have no comprehensive understanding of M-theory. My own point of view, which has guided my current research, is that these membranes and strings represent the condensation of space. Einstein tried to describe matter in purely geometrical terms, as some kind of kink in the fabric of space-time. If we have a bedsheet, for example, and a kink develops, the kink acts as if it has a life of its own. Einstein tried to model the electron and other elementary particles as some kind of disturbance in the geometry of space-time. Although he ultimately failed, this idea may be resurrected on a much higher level in M-theory. I believe Einstein was on the right track. His idea was to generate subatomic physics via geometry. Instead of trying to find a geometric analog to point particles, which was Einstein's strategy, one could revise it and try to construct a geometric analog of strings and membranes made of pure space-time. One way to see the logic of this approach is to look at physics historically. In the past, whenever physicists were confronted with a spectrum of objects, we realized that there was something more fundamental at the root. For example, when we discovered the spectral lines emitted from hydrogen gas, we eventually realized that they originated from the atom, from quantum leaps made by the electron as it circled the nucleus. Similarly, when confronted by the proliferation of strong particles in the 1950s, physicists eventually realized that they were nothing but bound states of quarks. And when confronted with the proliferation of quarks and other elementary particles of the Standard Model, most physicists now believe that they arise out of vibrations of the string. With M-theory, we are confronted with the proliferation of P-brains of all type and varieties. It's hard to believe that these can be fundamental, because there are simply too many P-brains, and because they are inherently unstable and divergent. A simpler solution, which agrees with the historical approach, is to assume that M-theory originates from an even simpler paradigm, perhaps geometry itself. In order to settle this fundamental question, we need to know the physical principle underlying the theory, not just its arcane mathematics. As physicist Brian Greene says, "Currently, string theorists are in a position analogous to an Einstein bereft of the equivalence principle. Since Veneziano's insightful guess in 1968, the theory has been pieced together, discovery by discovery, revolution by revolution. But a central organizing principle that embraces these discoveries and all other features of the theory within one overarching and systematic framework, a framework that makes the existence of each individual ingredient absolutely inevitable, is still missing. The discovery of this principle would mark a pivotal moment in the development of string theory, as it would likely expose the theory's inner workings with unforeseen clarity. It would also make sense of the millions of solutions so far found for string theory, each one representing a fully self-consistent universe. In the past, it was thought that, of this forest of solutions, only one represented the true solution of string theory. Today, our thinking is shifting. So far, there is no way to select out one universe out of the millions that have been discovered so far. There is a growing body of opinion that states that if we cannot find the unique solution to string theory, it's probably because there is none. All solutions are equal. There is a multiverse of universes, each one consistent with all the laws of physics. This then leads us to what is called the anthropic principle and the possibility of a designer universe. Chapter 8. A Designer Universe. Numerous universes might have been botched and bungled throughout an eternity ere this system was struck out, much labor lost, many fruitless trials made, and a slow but continual improvement carried out during infinite ages in the art of world-making. David Hume. When I was a child in second grade, my teacher made a casual remark that I will never forget. She said, "God so loved the earth that he put the earth just right from the sun." As a child of six, I was shocked by the simplicity and power of this argument. If God had put earth too far from the sun, then the oceans would have frozen. If he had put earth too close, then the oceans would have boiled off. To her, this meant that not only did God exist, but that he was also benevolent, so loving earth that he put it just right from the sun. It made a deep impact on me. Today, scientists say that Earth lives in the Goldilocks zone from the sun, just far enough so that liquid water, the universal solvent, can exist to create the chemicals of life. If Earth were farther from the sun, it might become like Mars, a frozen desert, where temperatures have created a harsh, barren surface, where water and even carbon dioxide are often frozen solid. Even beneath the soil of Mars, one finds permafrost, a permanent layer of frozen water. If Earth were closer to the sun, then it might become more like the planet Venus, which is nearly identical to Earth in size, but is known as the greenhouse planet. Because Venus is so close to the sun, and its atmosphere is made of carbon dioxide, the energy of sunlight is captured by Venus, sending temperatures soaring to 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Because of this, Venus is the hottest planet, on average, in the solar system. With rains of sulfuric acid, atmospheric pressures 100 times greater than those found on Earth, and scorching temperatures, Venus is perhaps the most hellish planet in the solar system, largely because it is closer to the sun than is Earth. Analyzing my second-grade teacher's argument, scientists would say that her statement is an example of the anthropic principle, which states that the laws of nature are arranged so that life and consciousness are possible. Whether these laws are arranged by some greater design or by accident has been the subject of much debate, especially in recent years, because of the overwhelming number of accidents or coincidences that have been found which make life and consciousness possible. To some, this is evidence of a deity who has deliberately arranged the laws of nature to make life and us possible. But to other scientists, it means we are the byproducts of a series of lucky accidents. Or perhaps, if one believes the ramifications of inflation and M-theory, there is a multiverse of universes. To appreciate the complexity of these arguments, consider first the coincidences that make life on Earth possible. We live not just within the Goldilocks zone of the sun, we also live within a series of other Goldilocks zones. For example, our moon is just the right size to stabilize Earth's orbit. If the moon were much smaller, even tiny perturbations in Earth's spin would slowly accumulate over hundreds of millions of years, causing Earth to wobble disastrously and creating drastic changes in the climate so as to make life impossible. Computer programs show that without a large moon, about a third the size of Earth, Earth's axis might have shifted by as much as 90 degrees over a period of many millions of years. Since scientists believe the creation of DNA required hundreds of millions of years of climatic stability, an Earth that periodically tips on its axis would create catastrophic changes in the weather, making the creation of DNA impossible. Fortunately, our moon is just right in size to stabilize the orbit of Earth, so that such a disaster will not happen. The moons of Mars are not large enough to stabilize its spin. As a result, Mars is slowly beginning to enter another era of instability. In the past, astronomers believe Mars might have wobbled on its axis by as much as 45 degrees. Due to small tidal forces, the Moon is also moving away from Earth at the rate of about 4 centimeters per year. In about 2 billion years, it will be too far to stabilize Earth's spin. This could be disastrous for life on Earth. Billions of years from now, not only will the night sky be moonless, we might see an entirely different set of constellations as Earth tumbles in its orbit. The weather on Earth will become unrecognizable, making life impossible. Geologist Peter Ward and astronomer Donald Brownlee of the University of Washington write, "Without the moon, there would be no moonbeams, no month, no lunacy, no Apollo program, less poetry, and a world where every night was dark and gloomy. Without the moon, it is also likely that no birds, redwoods, whales, trilobite, or other advanced life would ever grace the Earth." Similarly, computer models of our solar system show that the presence of the planet Jupiter in our solar system is a fortuitous one for life on Earth, because its immense gravity helps to fling asteroids into outer space. It took almost a billion years during the Age of Meteors, which extended from 3.5 billion to 4.5 billion years ago, to clean out our solar system of the debris of asteroids and comets left over from its creation. If Jupiter were much smaller and its gravity much weaker, then our solar system would still be full of asteroids, making life on Earth impossible as asteroids plunged into our oceans and destroyed life. Hence, Jupiter, too, is just the right size. We also live in the Goldilocks zone of planetary masses. If Earth were a bit smaller, its gravity would be so weak that it could not keep its oxygen. If it were too large, it would retain many of its primordial, poisonous gases, making life impossible. Earth has just the right weight to keep an atmospheric composition beneficial to life. We also live in the Goldilocks zone of permissible planetary orbits. Remarkably, the orbits of the other planets, except for Pluto, are all nearly circular, meaning that planetary impacts are quite rare in the solar system. This means that Earth won't come close to any gas giants whose gravity could easily disrupt Earth's orbit. This is again good for life, which requires hundreds of millions of years of stability. Likewise, Earth also exists within the Goldilocks zone of the Milky Way galaxy, about two-thirds of the way from the center. If the solar system were too close to the galactic center, where a black hole lurks, the radiation field would be so intense that life would be impossible. And if the solar system were too far away, there would not be enough higher elements to create the necessary elements of life. Scientists can provide scores of examples where Earth lies within myriad Goldilocks zones. Astronomers Ward and Brownlee argue that we live within so many narrow bands, or Goldilocks zones, that perhaps intelligent life on Earth is unique to the galaxy, maybe even to the universe. They recite a remarkable list of ways that Earth has just the right amount of oceans, plate tectonics, oxygen content, heat content, tilt of its axis, and so on to create intelligent life. If Earth were outside just one of these very narrow bands, we would not be here to discuss the question. Was Earth placed in the middle of all these Goldilocks zones because God loved it? Perhaps. We can, however, arrive at a conclusion that does not rely on a deity. Perhaps there are millions of dead planets in space that are too close to their suns, whose moons are too small, whose Jupiters are too small, or that are too close to their galactic center. The existence of Goldilocks zones with respect to Earth does not necessarily mean that God has bestowed a special blessing on us. It might simply be a coincidence, one rare example among millions of dead planets in space that lie outside Goldilocks zones. The Greek philosopher Democritus, who hypothesized the existence of atoms, wrote, "There are worlds infinite in number and different in size. In some there is neither sun nor moon. In others there are more than one sun and moon. The distances between the worlds are unequal. In some directions there are more of them. Their destruction comes about through collision with one another. Some worlds are destitute of animal and plant life and of all moisture." By 2002, in fact, astronomers had discovered 100 extrasolar planets that were orbiting other stars. Extrasolar planets are being discovered at the rate of 1 every 2 weeks or so. Since extrasolar planets do not give off any light of their own, astronomers identify them via various indirect means. The most reliable is to look for the wobbling of the mother star, which moves back and forth as its Jupiter-sized planet circles around it. By analyzing the Doppler shift of the light emitted from the wobbling star, one can calculate how fast it is moving and use Newton's laws to calculate the mass of its planet. You can think of the star and the large planet as dance partners, spinning around while clasping their outstretched hands. The smaller partner on the outside is moving greater distances in a larger circle, while the larger inside partner only moves his or her feet in a very small circle. The movement around the very small inner circle is the wobble that we see in these stars, says Chris McCarthy of the Carnegie Institution. This process is now so accurate that we can detect tiny variations in velocity of 3 meters per second, the speed of a brisk walk, in a star hundreds of light-years away. Other, more ingenious methods are being proposed to find even more planets. One is to look for a planet when it eclipses the mother star, which leads to a slight decrease in its brightness as the planet passes in front of the star. And within 15 to 20 years, NASA will send its interferometry space satellite into orbit, which will be able to find smaller, Earth-like planets in outer space. Since the brightness of the mother star overwhelms the planet, this satellite will use light interference to cancel out the mother star's intense halo, leaving the Earth-like planet unobscured. So far, none of the Jupiter-sized extrasolar planets we've discovered resembles our Earth, and all are probably dead. Astronomers have discovered them in highly eccentric orbits, or in orbits extremely close to their mother star. In either case, an Earth-like planet within a Goldilocks zone will be impossible. In these solar systems, the Jupiter-sized planet would cross the Goldilocks zone and fling any small Earth-sized planet into outer space, preventing life as we know it from forming. Highly eccentric orbits are common in space. So common, in fact, that when a normal solar system was discovered in space, it made headlines in 2003. Astronomers in the United States and Australia alike heralded the discovery of a Jupiter-sized planet orbiting the star HD 70642. What was so unusual about this planet, about twice the size of our Jupiter, was that it was in a circular orbit in roughly the same ratio as Jupiter is to our Sun. In the future, however, astronomers should be able to catalog all the nearby stars for potential solar systems. We are working to place all 2,000 of the nearest Sun-like stars under survey, all the Sun-like stars out to 150 light-years, says Paul Butler of the Carnegie Institution of Washington, who was involved in the first discovery of an extrasolar planet in 1995. Our goal is twofold: to provide a reconnaissance, a first census of our nearest neighbors in space, and to provide the first data to address the fundamental question, how common or how rare is our own solar system, he says. Cosmic accidents. In order to create life, our planet must have been relatively stable for hundreds of millions of years. But a world that is stable for hundreds of millions of years is astonishingly difficult to make. Start with the way atoms are made, with the fact that a proton weighs slightly less than a neutron. This means that neutrons eventually decay into protons, which occupy a lower energy state. If the proton were just 1% heavier, it would decay into a neutron, and all nuclei would become unstable and disintegrate. Atoms would fly apart, making life impossible. Another cosmic accident that makes life possible is that the proton is stable and does not decay into an anti-electron. Experiments have shown that the proton lifetime is truly astronomical, much longer than the lifetime of the universe. For the purpose of creating stable DNA, protons must be stable for at least hundreds of millions of years. If the strong nuclear force were a bit weaker, nuclei like deuterium would fly apart, and none of the elements of the universe could have been successively built up in the interior of stars via nucleosynthesis. If the nuclear force were a bit stronger, stars would burn their nuclear fuel too quickly, and life could not evolve. If we vary the strength of the weak force, we also find that life once again is impossible. Neutrinos, which act via the weak nuclear force, are crucial to carry the energy outward from an exploding supernova. This energy, in turn, is responsible for the creation of the higher elements beyond iron. If the weak force were a bit weaker, neutrinos would interact hardly at all, meaning that supernovae could not create the elements beyond iron. If the weak force were a bit stronger, neutrinos might not escape properly from a star's core, again preventing the creation of the higher elements that make up our bodies and our world. Scientists have in fact assembled long lists of scores of such happy cosmic accidents. When faced with this imposing list, it's shocking to find how many of the familiar constants of the universe lie within a very narrow band that makes life possible. If a single one of these accidents were altered, stars would never form, the universe would fly apart, DNA would not exist, life as we know it would be impossible, Earth would flip over or freeze, and so on. Astronomer Hugh Ross, to emphasize how truly remarkable this situation is, has compared it to a Boeing 747 aircraft being completely assembled as a result of a tornado striking a junkyard. The Anthropic Principle. Again, all the arguments just presented are lumped together under the Anthropic Principle. There are several points of view one can take concerning this controversial principle. My second-grade teacher felt that these happy coincidences implied the existence of a grand design or plan. As physicist Freeman Dyson once said, "It's as if the universe knew we were coming." This is an example of the strong Anthropic Principle, the idea that the fine-tuning of the physical constants was not an accident, but implies a design of some sort. The weak Anthropic Principle simply states that the physical constants of the universe are such that they make life and consciousness possible. Physicist Don Page has summarized the various forms of the Anthropic Principle that have been proposed over the years. Weak Anthropic Principle. What we observe about the universe is restricted by the requirement of our existence as observers. Strong-weak Anthropic Principle. In at least one world of the many worlds universe, life must develop. Strong Anthropic Principle. The universe must have the properties for life to develop at some time within it. Final Anthropic Principle. Intelligence must develop within the universe, and then never die out. One physicist who takes the strong Anthropic Principle seriously and claims that it is a sign of a god is Vera Kischakowski, a physicist at MIT. She says, "The exquisite order displayed by our scientific understanding of the physical world calls for the divine." A scientist who seconds that opinion is John Polkinghorne, a particle physicist who gave up his position at Cambridge University and became a priest of the Church of England. He writes that the universe is not just any old world, but it's special and finely tuned for life, because it is the creation of a creator who wills that it should be so. Indeed, Isaac Newton himself, who introduced the concept of immutable laws which guided the planets and stars without divine intervention, believed that the elegance of these laws pointed to the existence of God. But the physicist and Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg is not convinced. He acknowledges the appeal of the anthropic principle. It is almost irresistible for humans to believe that we have some special relation to the universe, that human life is not just a more or less farcical outcome of a chain of accidents reaching back to the first 3 minutes, but that we were somehow built in from the beginning. However, he concludes that the strong anthropic principle is little more than mystical mumbo-jumbo. Others are also less convinced about the anthropic principle's power. The late physicist Heinz Pagels was once impressed with the anthropic principle, but eventually lost interest because it had no predictive power. The theory is not testable, nor is there any way to extract new information from it. Instead, it yields an endless stream of empty tautologies, that we are here because we are here. Guth, too, dismisses the anthropic principle, stating that, "I find it hard to believe that anybody would ever use the anthropic principle if he had a better explanation for something. I've yet, for example, to hear an anthropic principle of world history." The anthropic principle is something that people do if they can't think of anything better to do. Multiverse. Other scientists, like Sir Martin Rees of Cambridge University, think that these cosmic accidents give evidence for the existence of the multiverse. Rees believes that the only way to resolve the fact that we live within an incredibly thin band of hundreds of coincidences is to postulate the existence of millions of parallel universes. In this multiverse of universes, most universes are dead. The proton is not stable. Atoms never condense. DNA never forms. The universe collapses prematurely or freezes almost immediately. But in our universe, a series of cosmic accidents has happened, not necessarily because of the hand of God, but because of the law of averages. In some sense, Sir Martin Rees is the last person one might expect to advance the idea of parallel universes. He is the Astronomer Royal of England, and bears much responsibility for representing the establishment viewpoint toward the universe. Silver-haired, distinguished, impeccably dressed, Rees is equally fluent speaking about the marvels of the cosmos as about the concerns of the general public. It is no accident, he believes, that the universe is fine-tuned to allow life to exist. There are simply too many accidents for the universe to be in such a narrow band that allows for life. The apparent fine-tuning on which our existence depends could be a coincidence, writes Rees. I once thought so, but that view now seems too narrow. Once we accept this, various apparently special features of our universe, those that some theologians once adduced as evidence for providence or design, occasion no surprise. Rees has tried to give substance to his arguments by quantifying some of these concepts. He claims that the universe seems to be governed by 6 numbers, each of which is measurable and finely tuned. These 6 numbers must satisfy the conditions for life, or else they create dead universes. First is epsilon, which equals 0.007, which is the relative amount of hydrogen that converts to helium via fusion in the Big Bang. If this number were 0.006 instead of 0.007, this would weaken the nuclear force, and protons and neutrons would not bind together. Deuterium, with 1 proton and 1 neutron, could not form. Hence, the heavier elements would never have been created in the stars. The atoms of our body could not have formed, and the entire universe would have dissolved into hydrogen. Even a small reduction in the nuclear force would create instability in the periodic chart of the elements, and there